Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.
Okay, bottom of 13, footnote 8. The Acharyas point out, however, that the severity of each of these offenses was tempered by its perpetrator's attitude. Chitraketu appreciated the exalted position of Lord Shiva and therefore remarked how wonderful it was that Lord Shiva was acting like an ordinary human being. He appreciated Lord Shiva's position, but when he saw Lord Shiva sitting in the midst of saintly persons and acting like a shameless ordinary man, he was astonished. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur remarks that although Chitraketu criticized Lord Shiva, he did not offend Shiva like Daksha. Daksha considered Lord Shiva insignificant, but Chitraketu expressed his wonder at Lord Shiva's being situated in that way. Srimad Bhagavatam 6.17, 7 purport. Because they...
I think that moment has arrived.
You just disappeared for a moment there.
Yes.
Who said that?
Talking about this offense.
Yes.
Why Parvati was so concerned? Well, let's say why did she first? What was the question? Was concerned?
Okay. Well, the thing is who's situated like he is? Chitraketu or Shiva. So the common person then might take it that they can make these comments and this and that. Right? Therefore, Hare Krishna. You gentlemen should go around, but you don't speak the language that I can explain that. Okay. He's a lotus. These others are new. So the point is that one shouldn't make comments about Lord Shiva's position. See, Chitraketu is making that comment because he's liberated, but due to the nature of his act service and that, as a king, then he's always surrounded with women. Right? And Lord Shiva, he's liberated, but then he's sitting there with his wife. Right? Because he's Purusha, so it's complete. Because if Vishnu was sitting there with Lakshmi, no one would complain. It's the same as Shiva sitting with Parvati, no one would complain, because they go together. So he's appreciating the amazement of this difference, you know, this contradictory elements like you see in Krishna. Being Shiva, he's non-different, but it's slightly different mood, right? So there'll be similar qualities will be there of this contradictory, you know, because especially when you're dealing between the masculine and feminine, right? If he's just dealing in the masculine environment, then that's another thing. But here he's dealing with both, so you always get that contradictory aspect. Was that something? So then naturally, then she's going to you know, this is not something that's brought up. You don't deal this way. So it's technically something between him and Shiva. He's appreciating the situation. What he forgot about is the aspect that women are present. You know, if afterwards he had said that to him, then it's not a problem. But he's saying it at that time. So then Parvati might feel shy that she's, you know, in other words, they're sitting amongst sages and she's sitting on Shiva's lap, so she might feel shy, so now she'll feel uncomfortable. So it's not proper. Things are going on fine. Right? You know? Just like when the cow is there, and there's a cow and a calf, right? And it looks very nice. If you're with somebody, the general tendency is to point that out. But according to Shastra, you're never supposed to point that out. As soon as you do, the cow, being very sensitive, notices that, and then it will be in anxiety. So then, you know, because the calf is there. So then they can't interact properly. They're always worried what's going to happen, and so it messes the whole thing up. Does that work? The cursing of Chitraketu is a highly instructive pastime. It reveals the distinguished characteristic of pure Vaishnavas. In response to Chitraketu's comments, Shiva responded as follows. My dear King, after hearing Chitraketu's statement, Lord Shiva, the most powerful personality, whose knowledge is fathomless, simply smiled and remained silent. All the members of the assembly followed the Lord by not saying anything. Srimad Bhagavatam 6:37. So it is true, it's a fact. Whether that was the perfect social moment to mention that, but the point is it's correct, so it's not a bad thing. You know, you're pointing out how he has these contradictory elements, but they're not a problem. So he thought that was just very interesting. You know, it's like the point that Uddhava makes, that the Lord is surrounded by women, but he's self-satisfied. So, Chitraketu is pointing out the same contradictory element. He's self-satisfied, but he's sitting there with all these Vidyahara ladies. And Lord Shiva is self-satisfied, you know, speaking to the sages, but sitting there with his wife. No, so it's the same point. Srila Prabhupada elaborates. Chitraketu's purpose in criticizing Lord Shiva is somewhat mysterious and cannot be understood by a common man. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, however, has made the following observations. Lord Shiva, being the most exalted Vaishnava and one of the most powerful demigods, is able to do anything he desires. Although he was externally exhibiting the behavior of a common man and not following etiquette, such actions cannot diminish his exalted position. The difficulty is that a common man, seeing Lord Shiva's behavior, might follow his example. As stated in Bhagavad Gita 3:21, whatever action a great man performs, common men follow. And whatever standards he sets by exemplary acts, all the world pursues. A common man might also criticize Lord Shiva like Daksha, who suffered the consequence for his criticism. King Chitraketu desired that Lord Shiva cease this external behavior so that others might be saved from criticizing him and thus becoming offenders. If one thinks that Vishnu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is the only perfect personality, whereas demigods, even such demigods as Lord Shiva, are inclined to improper social affairs, he's an offender. Considering all this, King Chitraketu was somewhat harsh in his behavior with Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva, who is always deep in knowledge, can understand Chitraketu's purpose, and therefore he was not at all angry. Rather, he simply smiled and remained silent. Right? So then it would be, the natural thing would be, okay, next time you don't do that, or, you know, you're careful. But at that moment, nobody cares, so it's not a problem.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But because it was harsh behavior, and Shiva is the senior personality, then she's making... You know, then cursing Chitraketu. Yes.
Another way to look at it is in her last birth as Sati, she set herself on fire, so this time she's playing it pretty cool.
Oh, I see. Yeah, okay. She read Bhagavatam 6:17:9 purport. While Shiva remained calm, his wife Parvati erupted in anger and cursed Chitraketu. King Chitraketu's reaction is equally instructive as Lord Shiva's. The great Chitraketu was so powerful that he was quite competent to curse Mother Parvati in retaliation. But instead of doing so, he very humbly accepted the curse and bowed his head before Lord Shiva and his wife. This is very much to be appreciated as the standard behavior of a Vaishnava.
When you get cursed?
Well, it also depends who, but yeah. It means next time, if there's ever a situation that somebody gets cursed by Parvati, you know,
okay,
who's
fine.
On the liberated platform because
okay,
of comment, then yes.
Yes. Thank you.
Srimad Bhagavatam 6.17.37. But the main point here is Prabhupada's comments. Chitraketu very sportingly felt that since the mother wanted to curse him, he should accept this curse just to please her. This is called sadhu lakshana, the characteristic of a sadhu or a devotee. As explained by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Tridara Pisuli Chena, Torara Pisa Hishnuna. A devotee should always be very humble and meek, and should offer all respect to others, especially to superiors. Being protected by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, a devotee is always powerful, but a devotee does not wish to show his power unnecessarily. However, when a less intelligent person has some power, he wants to use it for sense gratification. This is not the behavior of a devotee. Right, so here's a senior personality, and then this misunderstanding is there, so then you just leave it. Yes.
So we see in both cases Shiva didn't react to the offense.
Yes.
His Daksha and his Chitraketu.
Yes.
But then his wife, she did.
Yes.
So is it just the nature of women, or
it's there because then, like you said, you know, there'd be the connection between her husband and herself. There's the element of possession. So then it would also then fall, you know, be kind of a criticism of her. But even more than that, it's not so much that aspect, is that why would she tolerate someone criticizing her husband? Because there's technically, if there's something to say in this situation, you would say it to the man privately. You wouldn't say it in front of his wife. You know, because it's a different... But this is how it worked out, because then you have this pastime. So that's how the whole thing functions.
Is there also the element of how we should respond when a Vaishnava is criticized and humble for oneself?
Yes, no, that's there. Look, it's not necessarily this pastime was arranged just to understand that, but these are what you gained from it, because that's why, because Parikshit Maharaj is very surprised, because they first hear the whole part about the demon side of it, right? And then it's how is it this demon is responding in this way, like an exalted devotee? So then it's explained his position before. Both Lord Shiva and Chitraketu Maharaj were humble and tolerant and accepted everything as the Lord's merciful will. In contrast with the devotees in Chapter 2, the devotees in this stage pray not for deliverance from calamity, but see Krishna's hand at work in all circumstances. So then we're bringing out this thing, is that before, is that Indra, if there's a calamity in that, he goes to the Lord to remove that. But here we're seeing when you get to this level of like Lord Shiva and Chitraketu, they're not asking that. It's just, okay, it's the Lord's will, otherwise how is it happening? So then...
So this, from a mundane point of view, would be seen as weakness?
As a mundane point of view, it would be seen as weakness. Yes, but as from a mundane point of view, is that, you know, we see that the whole world is here for our sense gratification, so... Generally, is they always get things backwards.
Yeah. So it's difficult to progress.
You know what I'm saying? Technique they may get correct, but vision is always backwards. You know, occasionally you get that words of wisdom, but, you know, like if somebody has some words of wisdom, how much do they have? You know, they have that one sentence.
Yeah.
You know, a whole lifetime and they got one sentence. Okay, at least they got one sentence. Better than most people.
It's usually something that you don't actually change your life by. It's just something you say and it's nice.
That's there. But at the same time, as you may, they may live by it or something like that. But it's here and there. It's not everybody, you know, has heard some such points from their father, or from their grandfather, or from somebody. Or, you know, so it's rare that there's some kind of actual clarity. So generally, everything the view is opposite of what it should be, though. Because you're working with the same mechanical elements within the world, that mechanical element then generally develops. That gets better, but it's not that their view gets any better. You know, just like let's say you have when they would first start, let's say weightlifting as an Olympic sport. Now, what they would lift, that was not necessarily that great. Compared to now, at the time that was very amazing, but compared to now, not so much. So these techniques, looking at things developing, now they knew much more. But now, if you look at it, the quality of the life of probably that weightlifter then, you know, had much more substance to it, much more people involved in his life and the depth of it. Well, nowadays it's just about themselves and their muscles, you know. So it goes down. So the technique is there, but that mode of ignorance where they're looking at things backwards from what they should, that's getting worse and worse. So it looks like, oh, the modern society is so developed, they've developed so much, it's so much better. But it's better technically, but as far as anyone's personal life, it's not necessarily the case. You know what I'm saying? Who takes more advantage of the technical developments of society than, let's say, your you know, typical nerd, right? But you know, he's got the latest things in there and stuff. You know how he sets things up and how he can get the greatest advantage. But at the same time, how is his life as a person with other people? Right? Not much. So is the technical advancement doesn't make your personal life any better. It just makes your technique better. So if technique is important to you, then there's some more satisfaction. Right? But before, individuals took, satisfaction in development of technique. But even though it was simpler, right? They had some understanding. So whatever it was that they did, then, you know, putting on their hat or how they carried their cane or something. Something was there that was their etiquette and other things. So your technical elements were involved in your life. Now there's something separate.
Reason
for which? That
because
the mode of ignorance and passion are just getting stronger. Because mode of passion means that you are going to perform an activity to get a result. So to get a result means the technical aspect has to be correct. Otherwise, how do you get a result? Right? You know, if you want carrot juice, you know, it's not that you stick a whole bushel of carrots in the you know, dryer or something. You know, it goes around and around, but you don't get any juice out of it. Right? So you have to know the proper technique. So the mode of passion, then that's why. Not because of goodness. It's not they're doing this because they're supposed to. Right? It's just because they see some opportunity. But because it's not according to what they're supposed to do, therefore the mode of ignorance is therefore increasing. And then you have all the problems coming out. So it's just passion ignorance for us. Yes.
I'm sorry for barging in here and just asking a question, but it's been burning in my mind, and it seems to be kind of part of the topic, but you can disregard it if it's not. Just looking historically, like, it seems as soon as Lord Chaitanya was born, I mean, there was some technological advancement before that, but then after he was born, like 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th century, it just exponentially was exploding. Like, within 20 years, the printing press was invented and started being really used. And pretty soon after, we get the Industrial Revolution and factories and globalization, colonialism, And to me, it's...
Now that was definitely a good one.
Right? Right, colonialism and Lord Chaitanya, like, right at the same time. And I attribute most of the problems of the world to colonialism, or maybe all of the problems of the world. And
I mean, the Greeks had the same problem, and Romans, and they hadn't even started that yet, so...
I mean, it wasn't, like, colonialism...
Well, let's not get into the side point
yeah.
There.
What I don't get is, how am I supposed to believe that this is the golden age? Like, it doesn't look like the golden age to me. It looks like the world's getting way worse, really quickly.
The world is getting way worse.
And so, but what is...
Has
the golden age not started? Or is the golden age, is the birth of the golden age like a tiny sprout, and amidst all the weeds, we won't even see it until it gets stronger and stronger?
Well, it grows for 5,000 years and then declines for 5,000 years. That's how you get 10,000.
Okay.
That's one thing.
Okay.
The other thing is, when Lord Chaitanya comes, then everything develops, right? People's intelligence, their awareness, their, you know, arts, fine, everything. The one thing you left out was the Renaissance.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. No. Wait.
A little bit about that.
Okay. Yes. But that's what you notice is coming up, is that all these kind of people are using their brains,
yeah.
You know, and expect. So the point is that is facility. Now the problem is the proper mentality, you use facility how to elevate yourself. The improper mentality is when you get facility. Then you become proud and you use it for sense gratification. So when the Lord appears, then Lakshmi naturally appears, right?
But
Lakshmi.
Okay.
Yeah. So they're misusing it. That's all. But the point is that stuff's there for the devotees. You know, so the devotees, it's easier.
So maybe all this technology.
That's there. That's because people don't have the brain to remember what you said. So it's useful. It's not that it's essential. You understand? You have to separate all these things. There is the facts of the situation. Then there's what you do with the situation. And in dealing with the situation, then you have to be able to look at all those various aspects in a particular way. Okay? So, because the point is, yes, you have a group of persons who have understood that there is a monotheistic system, and it's superior to a pantheistic or all these other varieties that are there. Now, the difficulty comes up is that that system was already present for thousands of years, going very nicely. And like all these other systems, they would flourish culturally because they have a synthesis between their philosophy, religion, their lifestyle, social systems, economy, everything. So it's one homogenous system. Some are better organized, some are less. But in any case, you look at all the civilizations of the world, they were all prospering, every last one of them. Right? And so that's going on. Now, you introduce the monotheism and you try to spread it outside of its original culture. Right? Is this all making sense? Because you mentioned colonialism,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But who were the colonials? The Christians.
I
mean, No, listen. They were the Christians. That was the... Do you want an answer, or do you taste, you know, angst that the world's not perfect. The world's never going to be perfect, and if you want it perfect, you'll be in anxiety the whole time. There is no such thing as a perfect world, especially when you try to make it perfect from the second level of consciousness instead of the fifth. Because the whole idea is everyone cooperates together, lives together, and everybody does everything nice together. That's just something nice that we can all be materially happy. It's not about becoming God conscious. It doesn't address the soul, nothing. Okay? So, now, The whole point is that you have this particular brand of monotheism that then doesn't want to follow the old culture. And their whole thing is, we don't have to follow the old culture. Right? This is going to get connected to this morning's class. You can see?
Really good.
Yeah. So then, not following the old culture, then they say this will make it universally available. Right? So, therefore, because the original practitioners of the monotheism followed a specific culture that went back thousands of years. Right? But then what happened is, no, we want to make it available to the common person. But it wasn't so much about the common person as the persons who were professing that idea themselves were attached to being Romans and being educated in, you know, Greek knowledge and that which was good. So, in other words, you have a person who is not from a Roman background. Their parents are aristocratic and wealthy enough and influential enough to be able to buy citizenship. Right? And then in that position, then they're educated in that time, the highest would be Greek, you know, your ancient Greek, their histories, their philosophies, and everything like that. So that's hard to get, this all this arrangement. The person's attached to that. Now they want to make it available in that environment rather than sticking within the original environment. So then it's, you can be monotheistic without the ancient culture. Fine. But then what culture do you follow? You can't really follow the pagan culture, the Romans. And you can't follow the old culture. So therefore, you have to just take the basic, ordinary, common denominators of the regular man, that he wears clothes, you know, and he breaks his piece of bread and sticks it in his little soup and eats it. And that's about it. You know, okay, he uses wooden furniture, the bed's a little softer, blankets keep you warm. That's about it. Right? So now, you take that and you take the preachers of that, they go into a culture because they don't have a culture. Then what do they do to establish monotheism? They have to destroy the present culture, because the present, whatever culture that civilization is so interrelated with their philosophy and religion that they can't separate it. Therefore, you must destroy whatever culture it is, because you see, wherever those preachers went, the first thing they did was destroy the culture. That is evident in every last conquest. Right? That's the common thing. And because they claim themselves Christians and they're monotheistic, it's a higher understanding, though they themselves didn't really live what you call a Christian lifestyle. And being that they were, the only reason they were going around the world was to get wealth, therefore now that they've destroyed the culture, there's nothing to stop them from stealing every last bit of wealth there is. Right? So in other words, you should see the position of the conquistadors from its actual position of what it's doing. And it's not minded by the country, because being Christian, of course, they're superior to the savages. And therefore, if we have all their money, then great. It makes it work for us. Europe's still just barely, you know, chugging by on what's left from what they took 400 years ago. Right? Does that make sense? So it means the perception then puts it into a proper position. So that's why we have to be very careful now, is that in the name of universal religion, we don't follow the old traditions, because if you don't, what do you have left? And then you'll just end up with the same problem. So that means if somebody has culture, you'll have to destroy it. Like, let's say you have somebody join Krishna consciousness, they're from a background where there is rules about everything. We're talking about someone from higher class. Now they join Krishna, oh, you don't have to follow all these. What's that going to do to their character? Does that make sense? So it's not a strong foundation. Therefore, every other culture of the world had their various things, how the social systems would work, the rights of the people, the rights of the government, everybody's obligations, and it worked together. These civilizations have, some of them, been going for thousands of years quite fine. The European has never gone hundreds of years in the same form. Right? So this idea is that well, the modern is so much better because it cares for the people. It doesn't care for the people. It cares for the people is that their volume in the market. That's all. That's the only advantage to people. Does that make sense? So therefore, then when you're looking at these things, don't get so distracted by the emotional, because then you can't catch the thing, because it's bigger. It's polluted consciousness, right? I'm the controller. I'm the enjoyer. Everybody does it. Just the Europeans have their own unique way of doing it, and being the burnt remnants from the Kshatriya genes left over from when Parasaram made his tour of India, and those who escaped to the Kshatriyas, they went to Europe. Therefore, you find they have to go out and conquer everything. They can't just peacefully sit there. Right? Like that.
Sorry.
Yeah. Now, just to compare that, because so we say, well, why are we picking out them? Okay. So then, look at the group that escaped to China. That was all the Vaishya kings. Right? So now, if you look at it in personal developed martial arts, nobody does better than the Orient. The Westerners have never come up with something as good. Right? So it's not that they don't have that martial thing. They're always fighting. They have a civil war. 100 million people die. None of this, 20,000 people died, or 20 million people died in World War I, biggest disaster on the planet, right? 100 million die in one civil war in China, and nobody even notices, And they had plenty of them, right? It's not that they had one of those, and then there was no more China, and so then, So that's the difficulty. Is that, but because they were businessmen, so then the main point is their economics developed. So right now they're not worried about going and taking over the world by other means. They just economically control the whole thing. So it's just a different mentality because you're having a different kind of people. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense. So that's also the danger of what we were talking about this morning. Because if you think that, we don't require this culture, then what? You have to have culture. If you're conditioned, you require religion. So what religion you follow? So if you don't follow the Vaishnava, which is, the perfection of the mode of goodness, then what's your alternative? It's got to be passion and ignorance. Because they're not suggesting that we'd be smartest. So at least, it's just goodness. It's suggesting passion and ignorance. Like that. So it doesn't work out. And it's not that it's new. The idea is, this is new. It's the same old thing. That problem is 2,000 years old. Same thing. Aristocratic background, wanting to move in those circles, blah, blah. Same thing.
History repeats itself.
That's the revolution.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, like that. So therefore. So it's not that the idea, the intent, everything's not good. It's just that it's not a good technique to use, because it's been used before, and it's not that it does. It's if you take any religion of the world, the maximum that's there in volume is Christianity. But what about the quality of those who are seriously following it? That's another thing. You made it accessible, great, but it's not that their life changes. Many places of the world, most people will say, I'm Christian, but they don't follow anything that's Christian. They don't go to church, they don't do anything. They don't say grace, they don't say their prayers until they go to bed. Nothing. They don't go through the samskaras except for a birthday or something. Christmas, yes, Christmas. It means you have to buy presents. Right, and Easter is chocolate bunnies and stuff like that. Yeah, so it's like...
Does Godiva make chocolate bunnies? I'm sure they do, okay. And that's not a bad Christmas. Yeah, yeah.
So we were talking before about how to take...
Does that mean... What was it? Hugh Hefner was into Easter? Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, springtime.
Okay, go ahead.
We were talking before about how technique gets better, but in this case, because the vision is wrong, the technique does not get better.
Means the technique gets better, but the point of its use and application is like, why develop that technique?
Mm. You're not going to do anything with it anyway.
Yeah, it's just like, let's say, they wanted to get rid of people. They had perfectly fine systems for getting rid of them, okay. Right? But then somebody comes up with a very efficient idea, right, the guillotine, and then, you know, they can so nicely get rid of people. But it's not so necessary. You know what I'm saying? The previous systems were quite fine.
Yeah. Now they have drones.
Huh? Yeah.
Now they have drones.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, so it's you know.
It's interesting because the word technique comes from Greek techne, and that was really what the sophists against, you know, the Socratics were really fighting about, is they were teaching the techniques of rhetoric and getting ahead, whereas he was more about the good life and the absolute truth.
Yes.
And that was the main split.
Yeah. And that, and Socrates was how long ago?
It was like around 300 BC.
Oh, okay. So that so seems to be a particular juncture in time. It's a popular... But it still started again with the Greeks, with the Ionians. And that was really way back. I don't remember if it was 2,500 years ago for the Ionians or 2,500 BC. I'm not sure when, how far back the Greeks go. But in other words, it was that time, is that relativism. There's just, you know... We say it's good, so it's good. We don't say it's good, it's not good. So that whole... Yeah, so it's a eternal battle between the absolute truth and
the rest.
The, you know, and just whatever's good for us. Vox populi, yeah. It's interesting you put in vox populi into the folio. You get so many hits, and none of them are any... how you say? Very supportive. Yeah, they're not flattering to the top concept.
That's true.
Yeah. So the thing is we're not conservative, we're not liberal. We're broad-minded. Now, depending upon our conditioning, we may start from a liberal conservative background, but as you advance, then that broad-mindedness comes out and these others reduce, because it's not about one or the other. Right? Because there, you know, the question is all the problems of the world come up from colonialism. Well, what's colonialism? It just means I'm the controller and the enjoyer, and they just found out a way to do it, so therefore it's there. But otherwise, it's going on at every level and everything. So it's not a, you know, it's the same old thing.
And a lot of the civilizations that were conquered within their own sphere conquered each other. So.
Yeah, yeah, of course. That's all you... Before the... Means you always see is that pre-Christian, they're all the same.
Yeah.
Post-Christian, then they're all the same. You know? Means they were all developed before and they were all, you know, devastated afterwards. So. But yeah, they're always fighting amongst themselves. And that's just the material world. That's how it works. So it's never good. That's why the addition of Krishna consciousness, that's what makes things dynamic. Now, if you're going to add Krishna consciousness, since you have to use the social system, why not use the one that has the broadest range and the most ability to accommodate? Because the others don't. Like, if you're poor, then can you actually fit in nicely to capitalistic society?
No.
No. Right? If you don't have a good birth, you fit in nicely into the monarchy, like that. If you don't hate everybody and everybody, then can you fit into the anarchy kind of system, right? And if you're not really committed to your body, bodily relationships, and the benefits you get from it, how do you fit into the whole artistic scene? So the only one that can accommodate all those together, right? The non-intellectual doesn't like the intellectual. Right? The rich doesn't like the poor. The powerful don't like the weak.
Right? You know, so there's no system that accommodates all of that except the Vedic system. But due to the mode of ignorance, we take it that it's the worst system. But it's the only one that accommodates. Nothing else accommodates.
Because you have to give up the Purusha Bhav to actually apply.
Yes, you have to be at Purusha Bhav. At least you have to be doing your duties. Now, a Brahmin can be considered a gentleman and knowledgeable, even though he's dirt poor. But if you dress dirt poor in a Western environment, anybody who was of a better would walk out, would move to get out of your way. If you're walking down the airport and they're walking the other way, they will move to the side just to stay away from you. Right? It's just the way it is, because there's something wrong. You don't fit in. But the Vedic system, then someone could be like that and be very elevated. So that's the difficulty, is that it's the only system that works. But due to, you know, being misapplied and everything like that, it's not that it hasn't been misapplied, but so is every other system. You know, say capitalism has never been misapplied, like that. Democracy has never been misapplied. Okay, you know, so they've all been misapplied. So the problem is the only, and why are they misapplied? Because of mundane consciousness. So what's the way to correct that? Is Krishna consciousness. That's what Prabhupada says. Krishna consciousness solves all the other problems.
Yes.
Yes.
Can we say that because of the British colonization, India got so degraded and lost?
It became more, but it became the most degraded when they got independence. Yeah, I think it's August 15th, midnight, 1947. From that date, it went down faster. In other words, the Mughals were around for like 1,000 years. British were around for 200 years. What neither of them could do to destroy the culture in 1,200 years, the Indians themselves did in 50 years. So you can't really blame the others. They didn't help. That's there. They didn't help, but the core culture was still remaining. Yeah, so the point is, this is just, people want to get degraded, they get degraded. And if you don't, you don't. Okay. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments that Maharaj Chitrakesu being cursed by Parvati should be considered the mercy of the Lord. The Lord wanted Chitrakesu to return to Godhead as soon as possible, and therefore he terminated all the reactions of his past deeds. Acting through the heart of Parvati, the Lord, who is situated in everyone's heart, cursed Chitraketu in order to end his material reactions. Thus Chitraketu became Vritrasura in his next life and returned home back to Godhead. So then very quickly he went back to Godhead. But he had this wonderful pastime. Indra gets instructed. You know, so many things are learned from this, you know, like that. Yes, this curse is a blessing. That's why if you're looking at things that if they are from the material point of view auspicious, then that's good Krishna conscious. If they're not, then that's not. Then you'll always have a problem, because then there's the idea that material perfection will actually be one possible, and two, I'll get some satisfaction from it. One, it's not possible. That's why you can't be satisfied with material, because it's not possible. It's never going to happen. You're still going to have, you know, you have 15 mattresses, you know, piled up. There's still one pea underneath, and it still gives you trouble. Like that. So, to be insulted in public or to be condemned to take birth as a demon are forms of mercy, quite different than what we have been exposed to so far in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, right? Because now we've just been looking at that element of when facilities are good, yes. Then it's good.
Yes.
That one. What's his name?
Doyle,
that's the famous Doyle. He's the most famous, even more than Holmes. Opulence and high birth were praised in previous chapters, signs of Krishna's mercy, because they are. But now we're seeing other forms of Krishna's mercy that are even greater. Yet devotees like Shiva or Chitraketu's devotion is unmotivated and uninterrupted, regardless of external conditions. Now in this title and chapter, Beyond the Material World, Narada Muni begins to place increased emphasis on the inner qualities of devotion which transcend material position. Right? So in other words, there's the external symptoms of devotional service, which all the ones pointed out, the Brahman, the king, Indra and Brahma had, they're all true and all correct. But there is then these subtler internal conditions that are considered more important. Right? Does that make sense?
Yes.
So, yeah. 26. Once, just to please Lord Krishna, you expressed the desire to become even greater than he. But then you very cleverly modified your request, asking him instead to make you his devotee. This, in Lord Shiva's opinion, was a particularly egregious offense. Egregious. What does egregious mean?
Very severe.
Huh? Very severe. Egregious is very severe. Okay, thus in Lord Shiva's opinion, this is Shiva to Narada Muni. Or Narada Muni to Shiva. Or who's speaking here? No, but number 26, who is speaking?
This is Narada Muni speaking to Shiva.
Narada Muni speaking to Shiva, okay. Thus, in Lord Shiva's opinion, was a particularly egregious offense. Based on the desire to be worshipped, he confesses in the Brihad Sahasranama Stotra, Padma Purana Uttarakhanda 71-102, when I don't receive the worship I wanted, I serve Lord Hari thoroughly in devotional service, but with the egotistic motive of becoming even greater than he. In this way, Lord Shiva berates himself, but the truth is that even when he acted only for Krishna's pleasure, he acted only for Krishna's pleasure. He thought that Krishna would be displeased by a direct request that Lord Shiva become his servant. Since Krishna is self-effacing by nature, does not like exalted persons like Shiva to act subordinate to him. So Shiva instead submitted what seemed the opposite request. Krishna has declared his servant greater than himself. Mad bhaktya puja bhyadika. More important than worshipping me is worshipping my devotee. Srimad Bhagavatam 11.19.21. Therefore, Lord Shiva cleverly asked for that greater position. Lord Shiva had also once overheard Krishna while playing dice with his queen, Rukmini, declare his devotee even more glorious than himself, in order to allure the dice into acting as his devotees by serving him nicely. then he'll win, right? Therefore, the Supreme Lord granted you and the goddess Durga the authority to give liberation, the liberation for which Brahma and many others pray. Without Lord Vishnu's personal sanction, no one can become free from the cycle of birth and death. Harim vina naiva shritim taranti. Bhavarta Deepika 10.87.27. In the previous chapter, even Lord Brahma avowed that he feared his own mortality, that he desired liberation. In contrast, Lord Shiva, as Sadashiva, is without beginning or end. Having promised him a position even better than his own, Lord Vishnu deputed to both Lord Shiva and his wife the power to bestow liberation on his behalf. Right? Still, it's his potency, and he's authorized it. Right? Just like he authorizes Maya to for the workings in the material world. It's, so then it goes on. Right? But it's his potency. They're acting on his behalf. From the point of view of the materially motivated jiva, this marks Shiva and Vishnu as virally equivalent. Right? But it's still, the potency comes from Krishna. 28. Just see, though you have power and opulence unobtainable by Brahma and the other demigods, you disregard your material happiness and live like a holy madman, avidhuta vat. Right? Means he has more power and more opulence than anybody in the material world. His wife is the material world. you're not talking about just the one, all of them. Right? Because then you have a particular temporary manifestation within the material world. But his position as Sadashiva and his wife, they're eternal. But he lives like an avidhut. Not even like a simple Babaji or that, an avidhut, right? So you don't really worry about anything. 29. Always fixed in a trance of devotion for Lord Vishnu, you appear totally insane. Who else but you would go dance naked with his wife in attendance? Right.
Not many.
Yeah. This avidhut platform raised here is the stark contrast to the dutiful behavior of the earthly king and brahmana, or the sober demure of Brahma, who counts the personified Vedas as his associates. Hence it is fitting that Narad Muni, upon leaving the material world, should encounter someone who has forgotten its strictures. Srila Prabhupada elaborates on the avidhuta position. The word avidhut refers to one who does not care for social conventions, particularly the varnashram dharma. However, such a person may be situated fully within himself and be satisfied with the Supreme Personality of Godhead on whom he meditates. In other words, one who has surpassed the rules and regulations of Varnashram Dharma is called avidhut. Such a person has already surpassed the clutches of Maya, and he lives completely separate and independent, Srimad Bhagavatam 5.5.29. Right? So this is the only way you can get beyond. You can say, you have an avidhut who's not. But that's why they say avidhuts are like madmen. The difference is they're avidhuts because they look like they're madmen, but they're not part of this world. Well, the madman is. The madman wanted this world so much, couldn't get it, they've gone crazy. Right? But the avidhut is someone who's not interested in the world. And therefore, he doesn't have to follow the rules of the world. But he's always absorbed in the Supreme Lord. So that's the actual perfection. Because the one rule is always remember Krishna, never forget. So he follows that. So if he doesn't follow any of the other rules, it doesn't matter. Because that rule is happening. Right? So it's not a technique. Okay. Not to speak of surpassing Maya, he is wedded to her. Thus Lord Shiva's particular activities, including the incident before Mara's Chittaketu, are completely beyond reproach. In the avidhut stage, the Paramahamsa stage, which is the supermost stage, one may appear to be Vishayi on the platform of sense gratification, but in actuality has nothing to do with sense gratification. Sisi Madhyalita 385. That's why it just has to be the situation they're in. Right? Like that. Just like Gadadhar Pandit's guru. Pundrik Vidyaniri. He has all that facility. But it's not about the facility. That he's a king, so you use facility to do your service. And that way you can make things very nice for the Vaishnavas and everything like that. Okay. Today I've finally seen your amazing, uncontrollable eagerness to serve the Supreme Lord in devotion, in pure devotion. No wonder Krishna always loves you the most. What more can I say? Krishna's love for you is never interrupted. And by your mercy, many others have become dear to him. So if Krishna's love is uninterrupted, what does that mean?
His love is uninterrupted.
Yes, because Krishna reciprocates. So if your love is uninterrupted, that means Krishna's love is uninterrupted. Good. Because Krishna loves the living entities, otherwise why does he give them an opportunity to reform themselves? Why is he even given an opportunity that they can behave outside of what they should be doing? It's affection. Right? But that exchange that we call love, that's coming because of the devotee's surrender to the Lord, an expression of love. Therefore, that's why it's there. So it's, what more can I say? Krishna's love for you is never interrupted, and by your mercy, many others have become dear to him. So, by associating with Lord Shiva, following his transcendental instructions, many others have become dear to the Lord. Yeah. Narada is amazed that the greatest master of yoga discipline, the chief of self-satisfied sages, the husband of material nature, completely disregards common standards of cultured behavior. He does not even walk and dance normally. Lord Shiva's natural expression of his internal feelings, if exhibited by anyone else, would be considered unacceptable or insane. Narada understands, however, that Lord Shiva's unusual behavior is a sign of his exceptional greatness as a Vaishnava, who deeply tastes the ecstasies of devotional exchange with the Supreme Person. So this is that aspect, that avidhuta aspect that we see in Balaram. Sometimes he does, but generally this is on a as a regular thing that's tasted in that form of Sada Shiva. Right? But otherwise, then it's the other thing of establishing the rules, following the rules, doing all that. So he sees when it comes up is that Arjuna has stolen Subhadra. What's the problem? Right? Because they didn't properly respect the family, didn't approach, didn't do all those things. Therefore, then, you know, this has to be corrected. Right? But on the other side, you see, is that, as Nityananda Prabhu, he did many of these things that Lord Shiva's, you know, being mentioned about here. You know? So, this is where it comes from. So, Krishna can just take that balanced position in the middle, because the middle is the best. Right? So therefore, the two extremes, that can be tasted through Balaram. Does that make sense? Radharani, she's in the middle. Then you have the two extremes. Does that make sense? You know, so it's always this way, because it's that's the best. So this way you get these. So it's just natural. So Shiva can do that all the time.
Which are the two extremes for Radharani?
It means you have more right, more left. No, we're not taking it that far. No need to take it that
far. Don't mention
yes. Yeah. Okay. Lalita and Vishaka, because Lalita is left of left, you know, and then Vishaka is right of left. The other one you're talking is just, that's just right. You know. So, does that make sense? But even she has her two associates, will be left of right and right of right. You know, like that. So you always have. So that makes, that's why this one's. So then you have that, so these other aspects are there, so everything can be tasted, yes.
So when Advaita Acharya comes, he's tasting the, establishing the rules as the Acharya.
Yes, but at the same time, as you see, sometimes he does things that he doesn't worry about it. So, you know, especially with him and Nityananda, they tend to get a little avidhutish, you know, like that.
That's why actually he's considered the Pancha Ratrika Vidyashvai Advaita Acharya.
Advaita Acharya.
Is
pretty much, yeah. Pretty much, yeah. Okay. Nice. And that is from?
It was in the study guide.
It was in the study guide.
I read it in my
book. Okay, okay. Yeah, yeah. Sure, yeah, it's probably somewhere. Chaitanya Bhagavad, somewhere, yeah. Okay, is that? Yeah. So therefore, all the knowledge, all the rules, everything like that, so Advaita Acharya is the one who teaches. So he's one of the teachers of Lord Chaitanya. Yes?
Why would this consider to be more, like if somebody is
doesn't follow the rules. And then we see that it's higher than somebody who is follows the rules, because it said here that if we go from the material realm higher, then it's not astonishing that somebody is not following the rules, because there should be something different.
No, because they're outside the material world, so you don't have to follow the rules of the material world.
So this is the science.
It's just like this. The man is in the prison, okay? He gets out of the prison. Now, when he's in his home, does he follow the rules of the prison? Right? Gets up, you know, has a big bell on the wall, gets up, marches out into the kitchen, you know, turns left, goes there, you know, pours his bowl of Cheerios, you know. But, you know what I'm saying? He doesn't follow the rules anymore. But now, if we go back to this morning's point, what's the aspect that's higher? Is it the following rules and not following the rules? Yes. So that's the point. It's the primary element. In other words, we're looking at these secondary symptoms, the grosser symptoms of the Lord's mercy in Krishna consciousness. But now we're going to the subtler ones, the internal mood, that primary aspect, of that devotion. That's the main thing. Right? Because here we're not talking about opulence. Narad Muni is not really brought. He mentioned he has, but it's not seen. Like when he comes and receives Narad Muni, they just have like a grass mat to sit on, you know, and that's it. And so, you know, that's the whole point. Is in other words, the opulence in the material world is neither important to Lord Shiva or his wife, right? Otherwise, then they would have all kinds of stuff. But they don't, because it's about, you know, that mood is what's most important. Is that? Yes.
I think it's not mentioned that they were having a house.
They were having a house.
Not mentioned.
But they had a house? Did it say they had a house?
No, they had a Grihaprovesh, and then he ends up giving away the house.
Yeah. Because Parvati said, how come we don't have a house? And they're under a tree. So Shiva says, okay, I'll get you a house. So he, by his mystic power, made this huge, amazing mansion and everything. And because it's Lord Shiva doing a Grihaprovesh, everyone from the whole universe came to, you know, to extend the function. And so, you know, who's coming? Great sages and all this. And so he's giving in charity to everybody. Like that. But then the problem is that people just keep coming. So then he has to keep giving everything to the last person that came. He'd already, by this time, given away all the furniture in the house, all the wealth, everything like that. You know, the cows, the only thing left is the house. So he had to give the house away. You know, so then he and his wife went back to under the tree. So much easier. So there was a pastime of a house, but it didn't seem to go for more than a day. You know, probably even less than a day.
Yeah. Nice function, I'm sure.
Huh?
It's a nice function, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Not the part of
you. Yeah. So then, you know, they're good. Yeah, otherwise then if it was important to Parvati, then they would have made another house with a wall.
Invitation only.
Yeah. But it's not. So therefore they continue living under a tree. Okay. Right, so in other words, now we switch from these external symptoms, which are bona fide, to now the internal symptoms, which are more bona fide. Right? Yeah. Narad praises Parvati, 32-34. By Mother Parvati's mercy also, many other persons have become dear to Lord Krishna. She knows in detail the true nature of both Lord Krishna and you. Footnote 9. The Puranas tell of persons like Jana Sharma, who, by Parvati's mercy, became great Vaishnavas. Jana Sharma's story will be told in the second part of Sri Brihad Bhagavatamrita. Mother Parvati, Ambika, is Krishna's own sister, who always receives his affection. That is why you care for her, even though fully satisfied in herself, in yourself. Right? Because she's Krishna's sister, right? And so therefore, she's a great devotee, and therefore he's taking care so nicely. You give her pleasure by always
holding wonderful festivals with singing of Lord Vishnu's names and recitation of his glories. At those times, she enjoys the company of Lord Vishnu's devotees. Sri Parikit said, "Dear Mother, Lord Shiva was so embarrassed by hearing this that he lowered his face." Then that leader of the Vaishnavas answered the great devotee Narada. Sri Mahesha said, "Oh, how painful this is. My dear Narada, free of every trace of false pride, how can you compare me, the root of all pride, to Krishna, the Lord of prideless sages?" Right? Because the root of pride, because he's in charge of the mode of ignorance, and that's where it comes from. So, Narad Muni earlier equated Shiva with Krishna in both sharing the ability to grant liberation. Lord Shiva condemns this equivocation as misleading, considering himself, quote, "the root of all pride," end quote, diametrically opposed to Krishna, the Lord of pridelessness. According to Shastra, it is true that Shiva presides over the force of ahankara. Quote, "When the universe became filled with ahankara by the agency of Shiva," Brahma Samhita 5.16. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur explains, "The innumerable jivas as spiritual particles emanated from the oversoul in the form of pencils of rays of effulgence have no relation with the mundane world when they come to know themselves to be the eternal servants of the Supreme Lord. They are then incorporated into the realm of Vaikuntha. But when they..." I'm just saying no private limit here. Here? "But when they desire to lord it over Maya, forgetting their real identity, the egotistic principle, Shambhu, entering into their entities, makes them identify themselves as separated enjoyers of mundane entities. Hence, Shambhu is the primary principle of the egotistic mundane universe, and of perverted egoism in jivas that identifies itself with their limited material bodies." Brahma Samhita 5.16 purport. Thus, Lord Shiva blames himself for the false ego that pervades the material universe. Though Shiva associates with tamas, he is not contaminated. This is made clear in Lagu Bhagavatamrita 1.2.28. Quote, "Shiva is without a touch of the material gunas, since he is the Lord. However, the ignorant perceive him along among the guna avatars to be contaminated by tamaguna." End quote. Vaishnavas recognize that Shiva is the source of liberation from ahankar. In order to get released from the false ego, one has to worship Shankarshana, right? Because it's mentioned that Sesha, that he's the source of this ahankara. Right? So he's Shankarshana, so that's who Lord Shiva is worshipping. So in that form, he's been giving the blessing that he can then free one. Shankarshana is also worshipped through Lord Shiva. The snakes which cover the body of Lord Shiva are representations of Shankarshana, and Lord Shiva is always absorbed in meditation upon Shankarshana. One who is actually a worshipper of Lord Shiva as a devotee of Shankarshana can be released from false material ego. If one wants to get free from mental disturbances, one has to worship Aniruddha. For this person, worship of the moon planet is also recommended in the Vedic literature. Similarly, to be fixed in one's intelligence, one has to worship Prajumna, who is reached through the worship of Brahma. These matters are explained in Vedic literature. Srimad Bhagavatam 3.26.21 purport. So this is 26. This is coming up, I think, Kapila Gita. Shiva also explains that Lord Krishna is found at the opposite end of the egotism spectrum. He is the source of pure pridelessness. This too is explained in Bhagavatam. The Vasudeva stage is free from infringement by material desires and is the status in which one can understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead, or the objective which is described in the Bhagavad Gita as Adbhuta. This is another feature of the Mahat Tattva. The Vasudeva expansion is also called Krishna consciousness, for it is free from all tinges of material passion and ignorance. Vasudev is Krishna alone. When Krishna or Vishnu is alone, without the accompaniment of his internal energy, he is Vasudev. When he's accompanied by his internal potency, he's called Dwarkadish. To have clear consciousness or Krishna consciousness, one has to worship Vasudev. Srimad Bhagavatam 3:26.21. Right? So there, that's where the aspect of Vasudev, it's about the situation. It's not about rasa. I mean, it's about appreciating the Lord in majesty or in sweetness. Right? It's but that's position. So you haven't added into the element, because if you're going to make it dynamic, then you have to add Lakshmi. Right? The Lord has to be with it. Then there's the endeavor to please the Lord. Right? So therefore when you add, then you have the Kriya Shakti. But the whole point of that is to please the Lord, his Icha, his desire, and interacting with the devotees. So that's why it starts at Vasudev. Then when one's consciousness is pure, then it's all about serving the Lord. Therefore, under the grace of of the Lord, of Nityananda, or Sankarshan, like this, then with the Kriya Shakti, you're performing activities that are then pleasing to Krishna. So the Prayojana is pleasing Krishna. Does that make sense? That's why Balaram's the Lord of the Chit Shakti, because that's the knowledge and activities. So that's Kriya. Does that make sense? Yes.
Pleasing Krishna means also pleasing the devotees?
Because it's Krishna and the devotees. Icha Shakti means Krishna and his devotees, because Icha Shakti manifests Krishna's name, form, qualities, pastime, dham, associates, paraphernalia. So in other words, it's about the pastime. That is what is there. So that aspect. Does that make sense? At the same time, there's the aspect that the Jnana Shakti is manifesting the Dham and all the paraphernalia. But that is it's there. It's existence. Right? Because with the Icha Shakti, you're talking about the mood of interaction. Right? The existence of it, that's the Jnana Shakti. The engagement of it, that's the Kriya Shakti. But the actual experience of it, that's the Icha Shakti. So the real manifestation is the Icha. Just like we were saying this morning, the real manifestation within the material sphere is the primary creation. Because there, it's in knowledge. It's actually on the platform of Vasudeva Sattva. Then in the secondary, that's when it becomes contaminated. The modes then are managing.
We start to think it's interesting.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, we start to think it's interesting and the liberated start to think it's not. Yeah.
Is that why Lord Brahma was equated with Prajumna there? The desire to engage?
Yes, yeah. The desire, because there's that element of passion. You know? Because that aspect of passion is there, that interest, that... That's why everything's connected here. It's just a matter of which one you're discussing at the time. Because there's not anything that's not connected to the other and not interchangeable. Because it just, if you're looking at this perspective, it falls like this. If you adjust it over to here, then it falls in the other way. That's why if you take the yogpeet, depending upon whose vision it is, the yogpeet setup is totally different. That's why then we'll take Rupa Goswami's yogpeet. Right? It's not that these other yogpeets aren't correct, but it's just a different perspective.
Based upon the relationship?
Yes, based upon the relationship. Yes.
Also, it seems that to become free from false ego, intelligence in the mind, one can approach these are three elements of the Chaturvyuha through these demigods like Shiva, Brahma, and the moon, but to actually be situating Krishna consciousness and has to be worshipping Vasudeva.
Vasudeva. Because Vasudeva is the where all those come together. So there, it's this consciousness of Krishna in his pastimes with the devotees. That's what's really going to get the situation. So by that, then you'll actually be successful in appreciating Sankarshan, Prajumna, and Aniruddha. Right? But it's not that, you know, moon won't remind you of Aniruddha and therefore of the pastimes of the Lord and like this. But it's not that we separately have to worship the moon. You're already worshiping Krishna Chandra in that way.
get a better mood than that. Is that? Lord Shiva implies by this comparison that no real relationship can exist between himself and Lord Krishna, being so opposite in nature, right? So he's just presenting his humble, right? It's like we said before, is that they simply take other aspects of the position and only take approach that. They don't, its application, the reason they have that position or anything. They just take the position on its own and then say, you know, therefore, you know, my position's not very good. So, while he may be the universal controller of false pride, Shiva next attempts to show how he's still subject to its influence. 37. I am covered by many false identities. I consider myself the Lord of the universe, the all-knowing giver of knowledge, the liberated bestower of liberation, the devoted granter of devotion for Vishnu. Because he factually is. But he's just taking it that this is false ego. So he, because if anybody who's conditioned has any of these things, there's a problem. Right? And even those who are not conditioned, most wouldn't consider themselves like this because they're not. The Shiva is. He's the Lord of the universe. Who's the universe? His wife. Right? So he's the Lord of the universe. All-knowing giver of knowledge. He knows everything. He's been given that knowledge by Krishna. Right? The liberated bestower of liberation. He is liberated. And by Krishna's grace, he can bestow liberation. And the devoted granter of devotion for Vishnu, because he's the head of the Sampradaya. Right? So he factually is all these, but he's just using them. See, I have identities. You know? Lord Shiva describes himself as subject to Ahankara. He says he considers himself a dear devotee of Vishnu and recipient of Vishnu's special mercy. And such a mentality, he thinks, is but another influence of false ego. Because right? It says, one who thinks he's a devotee is not my devotee. One who understands he's a devotee of my devotee, he's my devotee.
Except Shiva, actually.
Yeah, he is a devotee of the Lord. Because he's the first expansion. Like that. So, why not? It means if Shankarshan, then the next expansion is this aspect, where you're dealing with the material world. Therefore, he suffers not from gross pride and material affluence, but more from the subtle pride in being the Lord's personally deputed representative, the highest position in the cosmos, in fact. While Brahma may reign over a single universe, Shiva expands himself into and administers over the entire Ekapada Vibhuti, manifestation of material energy. So Brahma is an expansion. Shiva expands into every universe.
Yes.
So they're quite different.
Passive and active.
Yeah, they're quite different. Position. Now he's the Lord of one universe, Shiva is the Lord of all the universes.
There is, however, one primeval Brahma who expands himself.
Yes. No, that's
not this.
But you, from what I can see, is you don't make as much a distinction between Vishnu and Hiranyagarbha in that primeval condition. Like that. Though, what you're saying is technically that is correct, because that aspect, Hiranyagarbha, that's what expands into each unit. But Shiva, because of the nature of the difference in kind of personality, and that therefore you see him quite different. So you hear about Mahavishnu and Sadashiva, but you don't hear as much about Hiranyagarbha. Like that. But it's technically, there is three, because otherwise he has a mentality, I'm the creator, so that's Brahma. I am the maintainer, that's Vishnu, and I am the destroyer, that's Shiva. So all three are there in the person at the same time as they're tasted as three separate. You know, that's the thing.
That's Mahavishnu, Sadashiva,
Hiranyagarbha. Yes. Well, they're the primary, because then they expand into the universe. Because Mahavishnu then expands as Garbhadakshaya, as Kiradakshaya. Right? Then Sadashiva expands as Shambhu,
and Hiranyagarbha as Brahma. Mm-hmm. Like that. So they're all there, but it's just generally Jiva takes care of the one because he can deal in that universe, but you're taking care of the whole thing, then that Vishnu and Shiva take care of. When the fearful time of annihilation arrives, in which everything must be devoured, I am obliged by the mode of ignorance to destroy the entire cosmos. When I think of this, I feel ashamed. Dear Narada, if I had even a drop of the mercy of Lord Hari, why did he fight me when he took away the Parijata flower, when Aniruddha stole Usha, and on other occasions? Right? Because if he has his mercy, then... Right, you know, but we see it's like Jai and Vijay. It's on the Lord's mercy he's fighting with them because they're the only ones qualified. Who else is he going to fight with? Right, so Shiva is the only one he can fight with. 40. Why did he worship me, his servant, and why would he order me, turn people away from me by concocting your own version of scripture? Right. Here Lord Shiva tries to prove not only that Sri Krishna hardly cares for him, but that the Lord actually holds him in contempt. Otherwise, Lord Shiva argues, Krishna would not have opposed him in battle on several occasions, as when Krishna stole Indra's Parijata flower and when Aniruddha stole Usha, the daughter of Banasura. Furthermore, when a master pretends to worship a servant, that servant is actually insulted and exposed to public ridicule. You know, it's just like, it's like... Yeah, I can only think of it in a pleasant way, but the principle is like, let's say you have somebody who's very expert or master at something. I've seen it where you have somebody who's new at something, but they have a little bit of knowledge. Then the teacher calls the student Ustad, which in North India means someone who's a master. You know? So I've heard it in that where it's like, let's say, example of the actual truck driver, right? And he has his assistant. So he sometimes calls the assistant Ustad. No, he's not at all. Right? But in that case, it's affectionate. But I've also seen it used where you have some people who are very expert in something and they're discussing amongst themselves. There has to be a junior person present. And then right in the middle of it, he pipes up and goes, no, but we can do this. And so then they turn to, okay, Ustad, what's your idea? But that way it's derogatory. So Shiva's using that one, when actually it's the affectionate one, right? So he's using it that he's being by he worships the servant, then he's exposed to public ridicule. Because it's the standard, that's the first thing. Somebody does something wrong, the first thing is sarcasm. Right? And when that doesn't work, then you may pleasantly say, if that doesn't work, then sarcasm. If that doesn't work, then you're quiet. And if that doesn't work, then you don't want to know after that what's coming up. The pretense may even indicate that the master secretly holds some grudge against the servant and wants to humiliate him. This may have been the case in such instances as when Krishna worshipped Shiva to attain an excellent son. Lord Shiva thus concludes that Krishna asking benedictions from him indicates not Krishna's favor but Krishna's contempt. That's how he's just presenting it. It's not that they're doing it, that they think, yeah, I am great, but, it's just, it's the etiquette to appear humble. They actually have a humble attitude. So then they'll look at it from this other perspective that puts it into this light. Rather than overlook Shiva's transgressions, Krishna punishes him in subtle ways. Lord Shiva is supposed to be a great devotee of Krishna because he teaches pure devotional service. Yet Krishna ordered him to teach Mayavad atheism. Of course, Lord Shiva is actually a pure devotee and a recipient of Lord Krishna's favor. Even this teaching, atheism, is done for the sake of protecting confidentiality of devotional service. Lord Krishna Chaitanya asserts the following in his discussion with Prakashananda Saraswati in the Sannyasas of Varanasi. Shankaracharya, who is an incarnation of Lord Shiva, is faultless, tada dosha nahi, because he is a servant carrying out the orders of the Lord. But those who followed his Mayavad philosophy are doomed. They will lose all their advancement in spiritual knowledge. CC Adi Lita 7.1.14. Right, because they're very detached.
Right?
But they're offensive to the Lord, so how you will maintain. Srila Prabhupada remarks on this topic. One may argue that since Shankaracharya is an incarnation of Lord Shiva, how is it that he cheated people in this way? The answer is that he did so on the order of his master, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In the Shiva Purana, the Supreme Personality of Godhead told Lord Shiva, "In Kali Yuga, mislead the people in general by propounding imaginary meanings for the Vedas to bewilder them." These are the descriptions of the Puranas. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur comments that Mukhya Vritti, the direct meaning, is Abhita Vritti, or the meaning that one can understand immediately from the statements of dictionaries, whereas Gona Vritti, the indirect meaning, is a meaning that one imagines without consulting the dictionary. So that's here. Right, so that's Mukhya. Abhita is Mukhya, and then Gona is that you imagine. Right, so we're not talking about here is that Lakshana, then Lakshana should be used to get the Mukhya understanding. So what we're seeing here is that Lord Shiva is using the Lakshana aspects and then bringing out the Gona from there. And even if he needs to use Mukhya, that it should be interpreted according to the Bhita Shakti, right? He's using the Gona anyway. He's using that Lakshana to give different meanings than actually should be given.
Yes.
Does this make sense?
Yes.
For example, one politician has said that Kurukshetra refers to the body, but in the dictionary there is no such definition. Right? Kurukshetra, you break it down in any way you like, it doesn't end up as the body.
Yes.
Right? Right? Because he's trying to say is therefore that because the body is the five elements, that's why you have five horses. And that's from an Indian painting, and somehow another one of our own devotees made the mistake and copied that. Krishna only has four horses, but he wrote five. You know, it's nice and balanced because the one in the middle is looking this way, that way, that. You know, you can make it very artistic. You know? Well, if you have four, then one has to look this way and that way. You know, it's more difficult, right?
The painting of the five horses running off in each direction, representing the five senses.
Yeah, but that's a different thing. Yeah. But that's not Krishna or Arjuna on the chariot, but this one has Krishna and Arjuna on the chariot. That's the other one. Yeah, so he's combined those, but that was because it came up, because that was a picture from the Indian thing that was based on this politician's definition. So he's saying this is an example where you give a Gona meaning. It's not Gona Vritti, it's not in the dictionary. Therefore, this imaginary meaning is Gona Vritti, whereas the direct meaning found in the dictionary is Mukhya Vritti or Abhita Vritti. This is the distinction, because Abhita, that's what you're supposed to be doing. Right? If you use this Gona Vritti, then that's not actually what you're supposed to be doing, because it's made up. So Abhideya is based on the direct meaning of the Shastras given by gurus and sadhus. This is the distinction between the two. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu recommends that one understand the Vedic literature in terms of Abhida Vritti, and the Gona Vritti he rejects. Sometimes, however, as a matter of necessity, the Vedic literature is described in terms of the Lakshana Vritti, or Gona Vritti. But one should not accept such explanations as permanent truths. CC Adi Lila 7.1.10 purport. So these are, you know, standard understandings, but it's just rare we don't catch them. He probably talks about them, because otherwise you bring these up, so the boys go, where's that from? You know, let's see. Yes.
So he's talking about these, sometimes, you know, we use these secondary meanings for the sake of preaching.
That's
not permanent truth.
They're not permanent means its reference is not, like you're saying, the village on the Ganga. It's not on the Ganga, it's on the bank of the Ganga. It's not floating in the middle of the Ganga. Right? So that's that. That will be. That'll have that. That it doesn't have that permanent element. Does that make sense? Sometimes they use those things. That the difficulty is because we're looking for gona vritti. Then if we find something's explained that way, we'll take it. You know, probably that's why you have to be careful in the letters, because he's talking to individuals. So he might use that element of gona vritti. You know, somebody's doing something, I'm so fallen, this and that. No, don't worry about it, it's fine, you just continue your Krishna consciousness. So, for those who are looking at the Abhida, vritti, they'll take it that Krishna consciousness is the main, even if one's fallen away, one still continues and gets back to the standard. Yeah. But if someone's looking for the gona vritti, then they'll see, it doesn't matter, we don't have to follow all these rules. Prabhupada said it's fine, you can go on like this. That's why the letters always have to be seen in connection with the books. You can't say, well, the books say one thing and the letters say another. Then it's, you take the book. When you can see the letter in connection with the book, fine, then you use both. But if you can't, you don't use the letter. Is that, no?
Can we use like the example of Bhaktivinoda Thakura referring to the demons in Vraja Leela and Krishna Leela as being a metaphor for like a particular vice? Each one representing a different...
No, because they do represent a vice, but they're actually there.
Yeah.
So they're real and a metaphor. So that's the difficulty. If we take the gona vritti, we'll say they're a metaphor, they don't exist.
Yeah.
So then we'll say, oh, the Bhagavatam is all metaphors and analogies, so it actually doesn't exist. So therefore, we don't have to follow all those things.
Yeah.
There are no guys following Vedic culture because it's all a metaphor. Therefore... God bless America.
Yes. Rather than referring to them as a metaphor, would be to say they're representative of our anarchists.
Yes. But the point is, it also depends upon the situation that you are, what is it you're trying to do. So you have Bhakti Vinod Thakur because of his position in the society, he's the one that's having to bridge the gap between the Vedic culture and the modern. Before him, no one had to do that. They were functioning in Vedic culture. That's all they did. Even anybody who was in the Mughal culture was the only other thing around. Then they, taking up Vaishnavism, would become part of the Vedic culture. But you don't really hear them remaining within their position. Only the Chankazi, he remained within his position. But generally, you always hear of those who just take up. So you only have to deal actually with the Vedic culture. With Bhakti Vinod Thakura, you're having to address the foreign culture. Because it's starting to have an effect on the lives of the Indians. Because before it didn't really. There were two separate worlds. But now it started to affect. So then he's dealing with that. So now if he's talking to the British, then he'll say, they're metaphors. And then because of that, they'll go, oh, it's a metaphor. Okay, so what's the instruction?
No.
Well, if you say, no, there's actually a demon there, and he's as, you know, tall as the clouds, and he looks like a bull. They'll say, no, this is not true. I can't listen to this. So they are metaphors. But he hasn't said they don't exist. But if I say they're metaphors, what's the thought of the materialist going to be? They're only metaphors. He never said it, but that's what they're going to do. But they'll take the instruction. So that's the expertise here, is even if you want to preach in this way, if you have to, which nowadays you don't, because, you know, all these things, Eastern culture and yoga and the Upanishads and Gita and vegetarian and all these things, these aren't strange anymore. Well, for the British, if it wasn't English, it was strange. You know, and even within, you know, the British Isles, except for England, it was strange. You know, so it's just that, you know, their ego was, you could say, as they had the greatest ego of anybody on the planet, as far as the culture goes. Such the smallest place, and they considered themselves the greatest, right? I mean, such a small country.
Still, to some extent, they have this.
Of course.
So they don't even consider themselves as part of Europe. They say, we're going to Europe. It's like, what are you then?
Or England.
Or British.
British, yes.
Yeah, what to do.
I tell you, you ask them how the empire's going.
Ah, how does that work?
Yeah, that works really fun. That's fun.
Yeah, it's fun?
Because they don't know, because they try to present this, I'm
characters,
but they try to present themselves as light and etiquette and that whole, and it just hurts. That's always fun.
Especially when the Danes owned half the place,
yeah,
anyway.
That's also true.
You do have that little bit of history there.
That's also
good. Okay.
Yeah.
we won't get into that.
Yeah, no, that's
so in other words, the North belonged to the, how you say, the Scots. The West belonged to the Irish and Welsh. And, what's in the center, half of that belonged to Denmark.
Yes.
So it's not a big place. So, in any case, we got into that. We got something into the pride. How do we get... Oh, and so therefore, that's the group of people you're dealing with. So he said things that would put them off their xenophobic guard and then would listen to actual Krishna consciousness. But he had never in any way been... how do you say? What would be a proper term?
Compromised,
yes.
Invalidate
the standard of the Vedic culture. So that's his expertise there. But if we try to do that, we generally do it by removing it, because we actually have some underlying faith in the modern culture, and he didn't. He could work with it, because that's what's going on. But it's not that he had any faith in it. Does that make sense? You know, it's just like the garbage man can work with garbage, not that he's thinking that everybody throwing stuff out is great. Like that. So it's just like that. So that way you get that you can do that, but you have to know what you're doing. That's why Krishna, it's a book by Samhita, that shows all the techniques of doing that. But you have to know what's behind it to be able to use them. Because if they say, well, what about the Navayagendras? Oh, they're just, some safe, they're just some, saintly persons. And then people can relate to saintly persons. Oh, okay. Or this group, oh, they're just kings. Right? We're not discussing that they're kings of the universe or, these things. They're kings. So in other words, why the modern intelligence gets distracted by the secondary to the point where you can't discuss the primary. How can I have faith in the Veda when it's all contradictory and you have these 30-foot tall guys and mystic powers and how can... No, but that's not the point. The point is about God consciousness. So you put the secondary on the side. So the whole principle is put the secondary on the side to get at the primary. But you're not rejecting the secondary. You're just putting it in its place as secondary instead of primary. But because we identify everything by the secondary, we'll say, "See, the Thakur doesn't care about these things." Does that work? Yeah. So they are, because they do represent those things. But at the same time, as they are demons that are actually there in Vrindavan.
Yeah.
Yes. Sorry.